You are listening to Season 2 of Conversations in the Gospel of John. This is Episode 7. This episode was recorded in the spring of 2024 at French University in Wichita, Kansas. Welcome to the second season of Conversations in the Gospel of John. I'm here today with my co-host, Douglas Estes.
Hi, I'm Douglas. I've written and edited books on the Gospel of John and published essays and articles on the same topic.
And I'm Stan Harstein. Recently, I've been doing more work in 1 John, and so it's going to be a great pleasure for me to come back into the Gospel of John. We are recording these podcasts at Friends University in Wichita, Kansas. We're grateful that you are listening to our conversation around the Gospel of John. Today, our guest in our conversation is Andy Byers. Originally from Georgia, he finds himself currently in Cambridge, the United Kingdom. Andy, what would you like to tell our audience about yourself?
Well, Stan, thanks. I'm really glad to be with you and Douglas today. And as you said, I'm from the U.S. And my accent gives me away, of course, over here in Cambridge. I've been here for 2 years, a little over 2 years. But I've been in the UK for 12 years. I am a Baptist minister in an Anglican world. For the first 6 years of my teaching career, I was affiliated with Cranmer Hall at St. John's College, and now I'm at Ridley Hall here in Cambridge, part of the Cambridge Theological Federation. Like the two of you, I love working on and writing on the Gospel of John.
One of the first things we ask, just to clarify for our audience, is way back when you were just thinking about doctoral studies or graduate studies, what caused you to be so interested in studying the Gospel of John?
It was actually before I ever imagined myself pursuing any form of an academic vocation. You know, today we have this socially acceptable phrase called gap year, where it's socially accepted that some people, after they finish university or maybe before they start, they may take a year off, right, and do some traveling. I decided I wanted to travel overseas, and I wanted to live by faith. To be honest, I now look back on that as a fairly misguided season in many respects, but thought, well, you know, God doesn't want me to work in a secular job and keep doing the landscaping I was doing or go back to the lumberyard I was working at. He wants me to do something godly and holy, like pray all day and read the Bible all day. So it was misguided in many respects, but this was where I was in my spiritual growth and development at the time. I followed those impulses and spent a lot of time praying and reading the Bible. And I don't know why, but it was the Gospel of John where most of my focus was directed, in that Bible reading. In no way did I think I would do a doctoral thesis on this or dissertation on this, but that's exactly what happened.
We're going to look at John 17 is what you've been looking at most recently. So what lens do you use as you're looking through the gospel now in 2023 that would help our audience understand the approach we're going to take today?
Well, since I'm talking to someone who's written a book on reading John through Johannine lenses, I'm tempted to say I'll try to read this through a Johannine lens, Stan. Yeah, you refer to the fact that when I was first interested in this this theme that I ended up writing on years later, I had none of the technical terminology at my disposal that later on I began to hear as a doctoral student and as a seminary student, actually, before that. As far as the lenses through which I view the Gospel of John, I mean, I'm certainly drawing on a range of tools. So the historical critical tools that are available to us as we work with these texts as artifacts from the ancient world that arise out of specific social and historical contexts. I remember also sitting in a class at Beeson Divinity School, and Dr. Norfleet Day was teaching on the Gospel of Mark. One of the most profound revelations for me in seminary at Beeson was that the Gospels are narratives. Now, that sounds really obvious, but I grew up with a strong appreciation of narratives. I was reading books at a young age, devouring novels. My dad taught English literature at a high school for years, and he would come home and read to us. Like, at my bedtime stories were Edgar Allan Poe, right? So I had a real appreciation for literature, but I'd never thought of these texts as literary. They were just these devotional things that we did and read in church or in the morning in our quiet times. And that revolutionized my approach to these texts, thinking of these authors as literary artists. So you've got the historical critical tools I'm drawing on, and then what we call narrative criticism, or engaging the gospel, these gospel texts as stories, and attentive to all that goes into making a story happen. But I'm also very much a theological reader of these texts. I'm very much interested in God addressing me, God addressing the church through my reading of the text. So it's a confessional and theological lens as well.
Well, a couple notes on that. First, you had the wonderful experience with Dr. Norfleet Day. I only knew her as Norfleet Day. She was in the program when I was studying at Baylor. Theologically, it's a great thing that we have Douglas with us today, because I estimate that you and he think more theologically about the text than I actually do. I tend to be very, very practical in that sense. But let's go into John 17. When I wrote my chapter on John 17, what stood out to me opposed to John 5 or 12 was the total diversity of approaches taken across the board. What piques your interest in John 17, and what are you thinking about and working on these days, Andy?
Well, I have a lot of chords on my Johannine guitar that I like to strum, but one of them that I am constantly thinking on and playing, so to speak, is on the theme of oneness, actually, that appears here in John 17. One of the features of this text, this idea of praying that they may be one as we are one, I have done quite a bit of writing on this theme of oneness, arguing that it's not the way it's been interpreted. I argue that it's not to be understood primarily as a call to unity for a fractious and divided Johannine community. And context, you know, for us biblical scholars and for those preachers listening, Bible study leaders, we know that context is important, right? To understand the meaning in these texts. And I suppose the first thing I would want to point out is that this oneness idea, or this whole prayer even, it's not designed to address an internal problem as much as an external problem. So if you look at John 16, just right before Jesus prays, in John 16, 29, Jesus is explaining to his disciples that a crisis is about to befall them. And this is the crisis of his departure, which leads to their scattering. So he is the shepherd who will lay down his life for the sheep. And in that act of his own death, there will be a scattering of these disciples. And so this prayer is one of gathering them into one. And the scattering is one that comes about from external forces, actually, that are threatening them. And as you turn the page into John 18, you see that there is this large contingent that comes to arrest Jesus, and they are scattered. So it's really external opposition that is creating the crisis here, not so much internal fraction and debate and internal, as Walter Bauer calls it, fratricidal hatred.
Right.
His comment 1 John. That's not necessarily what we see happening here. What we see is an outside set of forces that are threatening the integrity of this community. They're being scattered.
The thought that just pops in my mind as we have this little conversation is, not only does he ask that they would be one, but that others would believe because of that. And that jumps me right over to chapter 20 at the end, after Thomas' confession, where Jesus says, "Blessed are those who will believe without seeing." So there's an internal link between this that defies some of those historical critical approaches that say, well, this was just here and this was here and we've got this going on. Because as literary people, we're trying, what is the text trying to say? How are we hearing it? And it just jumped out to me that concept of other people believing and Jesus' words after the Thomas confession are intricately related in that regard. So,
yeah, Stan, that really helps my case. Thank you for that.
Anything to help you.
Yeah, hey, thanks. Well, what you are directing our attention to has to do with the language often used is behind the text and in front of the text. And you're calling us, what I'm trying to say and what you're affirming here is that actually there's a rhetorical aim that's looking in front of the text to the readers who will come across this text later, more than trying to reflect or mirror an internal set of debates or disputes. But if we go back even further in the gospel, oneness has been undergoing a very intentional theological development throughout this gospel. So it first appears in John 8, and here we have a reference to the Shema. So this is the confession of Israel, isn't it? Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. And in John chapter 8, there's a reference to the Shema in which that I think signals this is where John is thinking. I'm turning my pages there to get to John 8. We have one Father, even God, the Jewish leaders say to Jesus. So that idea of one Father is drawing on the idea of the Shema. And then when we move a little further, we see that John is also interested in the oneness language, not just of the Shema in Deuteronomy 6:4, that theological oneness. He's also interested in the oneness language in Ezekiel chapter 34 and Ezekiel 37. And here we have reference to one David, right? One king, and also the gathering together of Judah and the tribes of Israel into one. So this is one of the theological crises in the Old Testament, that we have one God, but yet the nation is divided into two. So there is a division here. So there is a social element here that we need to consider bringing together these two. But this sort of this sort of language of oneness that is theological is being paired with this social oneness and with the Christological oneness of one shepherd who will come one day to bring them together. So what I think is happening here in John 17 is that this is a call for the disciples and the hearers of this gospel, the later readers of this gospel, to align themselves with the one God of Israel under the one shepherd who Ezekiel tells us will come one day to bring us together into one people.
You know, one thing that you mentioned... I couldn't avoid it. One thing that you mentioned that I thought was very interesting. So I'm going to make a comment rather than a question. But earlier this year, I published an essay in Catholic Biblical Quarterly about the paradox in John 13:20, which, as you were speaking, made me realize actually how related what I was talking about to what you're talking about. Because my argument was simply the fact that in order to explain the mission of the disciples, that John utilizes a paradox there to say that Jesus's mission is, well, God's mission is Jesus's mission, which is disciples' mission, which is our mission. And he puts it all together in one neat little paradoxical package. So, I mean, in a way, you mentioned that as well, because even in oneness, there's still plurality thoughts.
Yes. Yes. Very good. I like that. The oneness, there's still plurality. Yeah, this is a major Johannine theme. Oh, we might call it a paradox, Douglas, to go with your language.
Yeah.
The idea of unity and plurality are in the very first lines of the gospel. In the beginning was, and a Jewish hearer of this text would supplant already, God. But oh, wait, no, Logos. So we sort of equate Logos and God. We think, oh, they're one, right, these two. But then the very next line indicates that they are actually not one and the same. The word was with God. Oh, wow, wait a minute. They seem to be distinct beings. But then the word was God. Oh, wait, no, they are the same. And then the next line, he was in the beginning with God. So there is this unity and a plurality that coheres around who Jesus is and who God is and their interrelation. You know, when you read through John 17 and you follow that oneness language, it's there. And as you mentioned, Stan, John 17, 21 through 23, but it's also in it's in verse 11 and 12, or yes, verse 11. There's a lot of inness language, that they may be in you as I am in you, and we may be in them, right? So this oneness is an inness in some way. It's not just let's all agree on some confession or creed, which is important. It's deeper than that. It's like we're identified as God's people because we are enclosed within him in some way. We are comprehensively participating in the relational reality of the unity and plurality of Father and Son. And I would say parenthetically by the Spirit, because John certainly will emphasize that that is something to be coming later in the life of the church, actually. So I think this is a call to be inside the reality of God, enclosed within who he is and within that sort of relationality that we see Jesus sharing with the Father. So a oneness that is also an inness.
So let me ask a meta question, if you will, okay? I was thinking about it as you were talking. I would describe myself as not a fan of the theories of Johannine authorship that include the idea that there was a lot of fighting in the Johannine community and a lot of fighting between the Johannine community and other Christian communities. I think they debated things, sure. You know, this idea that there was deep emotional damage to the author. I'm not sure that I can go there. So recognizing that's a limitation of mine, this whole talk about the unity, this oneness, but also this plurality, is it possible that it is an echo of what is going on in the author's life? I mean, is there a possibility, like even when we get to the end of the gospel and you have the plural we, you know, it's an emphasis of everything that's going on in John 17. It's not actually a statement about brokenness, but is actually more of a statement of unity, and we interpret it as brokenness.
Hmm. Douglas, yeah, I actually agree with you, of course. I do think it relates to a particular context. I think that there is certainly an attempt by the author to help what I believe to be a Jewish Christian audience understand their Christ belief within a Jewish theological framework. I think what John is doing is he's drawing on Israel's scriptures, Israel's theological tradition, to create a vision for how they can understand these Johannine Christians, who I believe are Jewish Christians, how they can understand what's happening and who they are in light of challenges from their context that they've departed from their heritage. I think this oneness language in John 17 is a way of securing there maybe some uncertainty around the fact that maybe they've compromised or departed. No, actually, John prays, or has Jesus pray, the prayer is that you may be one, aligned with the one God of Israel, who has sent the one Messiah, long anticipated in Ezekiel, that you might be the one people of God. You are actually part of the one people of God, regardless of the conflicts that externally are being lodged against you. So yeah, I think this does relate to a context. And I'm only comfortable being general about that context, but I think generally there is a conflict between this Jewish Christ belief within the wider Jewish milieu.
So if a pastor came to you and said, you know, Professor Byers, based on your great wisdom and knowledge, I am wanting to teach on John 17. What is one historical thing that I don't want to miss? What is one theological thing I don't want to miss? And what is one literary thing that I don't want to miss when I teach this text on Sunday?
This is great. I actually did preach from this text about a year ago, actually. So I was perceiving it from that sort of angle. I think a couple of things that are so important, and these won't necessarily map tidily onto the categories you just gave me, Douglas. Sorry. But I mean, I think this text is like Ephesians 1. And that we hardly have anywhere else than outside of, say, Ephesians 1 and here, maybe Colossians 1, such a grandiose sense of who we are in Christ as God's people. I mean, we are loved as God loves Jesus, we hear in this prayer. I would want a congregation to know this. Also, we share in the glory, the divine glory that Jesus shared with his Father. This is part of their prayer. I think it's also really important pastorally for people to know that Jesus prayed for you. Jesus prayed for them, for us. In this prayer, there is also a prayer for those who will come along later and believe. And I think it's also important to point out the missional element of this. And something that came out in my own work here, my own sermon on this text, is that one of the most missional acts that we can offer the world is to recognize that we are ourselves loved by God. And that is coming right out of this text. Obviously, to be missional is to love others. But another missional act may be to live as if we actually are loved the way Jesus says that we are loved and the way he interacts with his Father in this prayer.
So what I hear you saying is that the mistake that might be made in trying to cover this passage in a Bible study is to not make it too focused on ourselves and the disciples, but to make it more focused on what Jesus has done.
Well, obviously, we want to focus on what Jesus has done. Yeah. Some people need to stop reflecting on themselves so much, but some people need to hear, oh, actually, no, Jesus does. God loves me the way he loves Jesus. So I think those two actually belong together in many ways. Obviously, I would always want to be more Christologically centered. But if we recognize that the glory that Jesus shares is ultimately displayed by the glory of Christ crucified on the cross, as John puts it here in his gospel, that sort of selflessness, glory displayed in selflessness, then I think we can't own some of these benefits that Christ makes for us, makes available for us.
Two thoughts that I have about this conversation. One is closely related, and that is, as I mentioned in my intro, I've been doing a lot of work in 1 John. And the verse that really struck me as I was working through 1 John is 4:16. And both of the verbs are in the perfect tense, right? But he says, we have come to know and have come to believe the love which God has for us. And depending on how the verses separate, that's kind of different. Because then it goes on for the second time to say, God is love, and the one who abides in love abides in God, and God abides in him. And what the writer of 1 John is saying is, I think, a recognition, depending on, you know, chronological order and stuff like that. But the love God has for us is making a difference in how we live. And therefore, we are abiding in God because we recognize he loves us. I'm not trying to earn it, not trying to gain it, not trying to do all those things. So I think that's the one point that stands fairly close to what we're saying. The second part, which I, in my older age, I'm starting to ponder, as some older scholars do, is the relationship between Paul and John. And that as you were talking about all that in this, I couldn't help but think that is John describing in Johannine language the concept that Paul uses of simply being in Christ?
Yeah, well, hey, thanks for that. I'm grateful for the reference to 1 John 4 and the idea of God is love. That's helpful for me. I want to think more about that in relation to John 17 and the love that we see described there. I think he very much is, in his own idiom, picking up on this idea of what we call participation in Paul and providing a robust and theologically sophisticated and narrative format vision of how that works.
So, Douglas, any final thoughts or questions?
Yes, let me ask this question. So, given all the things that we've talked about, what is the one thing that you would be worried someone would miss if they went to a Bible study and they taught this?
Yeah, I think what I would be most concerned they would miss is the cumulative development of oneness that has already been underway in John's gospel long before Jesus prays that they will be one as we are one. I think the way we handle text often in preaching and in Bible studies is that we get the little chunk of text, right, that we're assigned, and we just work with that. What I found so helpful in seminary is the assignment like Norfleet Day gave me. Go read Mark tonight, the whole book. I thought, really?
Really?
And since then, when I'm preaching from a text, I will read large sections of the text, either the whole thing through or the whole section, large section, just to ensure that I'm not missing some sort of prior development. Because, we're all, those of us here on the podcast, we're all alert to the fact that these texts, they're not just little chunks or pericopes, as they've often been called. They actually belong in either a longer series of arguments, or they belong in a longer series of threads that keep unfurling, that keep being developed. So yeah, that's what I would be afraid they would miss.
We talked about history,
Sorry.
Theology, and literary approaches,
Yeah.
right? So in one sentence or less, can you explain how your approach manages history, theology, and literature, how you put all three of those together?
I'm trying to be attentive to the theological force behind oneness and its prior literary development, right? And understand that theology and literary development within a particular but general historical context of early Christianity, with early Jews who were Christians struggling within their wider Jewish milieu.
Okay, great. I don't have any other questions.
Well, we do appreciate this time. We thank you for being our guest on this second season of Conversations in the Gospel of John. We hope that you can utilize some of our materials, and but most specifically, we hope that our audience can take some of these ideas that we have going on in our heads almost constantly as we're thinking about the big picture and trying now to bring it down to what is really applicable, which John's trying to do. He's trying to say, this is a big story, but here's the basis, people. You're going to have some trials, as you mentioned. You're going to be going out. There's going to be some changes, and you need to abide. And that is demonstrated in oneness, I think. But we appreciate it, and thank you very much. Douglas and I want to thank you for joining us for the first episode of Season 2 of Conversation in the Gospel of John. Please contact us at cgj@stanharstein.com if you have any comments. We look forward to hearing from you. Bye now.